From WXXI News, in partnership this hour with WDKX 103.9 FM, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made 50 years ago tonight on a steamy July night in Rochester. Violent demonstrations broke into 3 days of protests. Some called it rioting. Some would call it rebellion. 4 people ended up dead, hundreds injured, more than 1,000 arrested, more than 200 businesses in Rochester were damaged, some entirely destroyed. What sparked those events? What was the result in the years to come? What's been the legacy? And how have we changed? How have we not changed? My co-host for this hour is Tariq Spence as we simulcast on WDKX. Tariq, had a great morning with you over there, and it's nice to have you in our studio this time.
And thank you for inviting me over. It's always great to be here at WXXI.
Well, it's great to have you here also in studio, and it's a full studio for the hour. Gap Mangione is here, who is now known as a piano player. But Gap, at the time, was there and, in fact, family-owned a business. Where, Gap?
Well, I was a piano player back then as well.
Oh, that's fair.
Chuck,
that's
Chuck
fair.
Was a trouble player, so. It was on the corner of Martin and Grant Street. That's one block east of St. Paul Street. So we were a solid distance from where the original explosion took place. My father had a grocery store. It was a very neighborhood kind of grocery store. And it was much more than just a grocery store. It was a relationship with the people who lived within walking distance of the place.
Mangione's Market.
Mangione's Market.
All right. Well, we're going to be talking about that. Daryl Porter is here, a past assistant to the mayor, both mayors Bob Duffy and Tom Richards. And Daryl was there in the thick of it in July 64. It's nice to have you in studio, Daryl.
Thank you for having me.
John Klofas is here, RIT professor of criminal justice and director of the Center for Public Safety Initiatives. Professor Klofas, nice to see you here.
Good to be here.
Daryl Porter, you were there on those 3 days, but we've been talking about them as if they were sort of one event, and I want to start with the fact that what happened 50 years ago tonight, was it spontaneous, or was it building? Was it inevitable, if not that night at some point? How would you describe it?
It was spontaneous that night, and it was building. I believe it would have happened somewhere at some time. Might have been even worse if it happened later as opposed to then. But it definitely was spontaneous.
What were the specific frustrations, what were the tensions specifically stemming from that made it feel like that was inevitable?
Well, the housing situation, the poor housing situation that was down there, the lack of jobs was a huge problem. Education was a huge problem back then. Health was a huge problem back then. There were all kinds of issues that were on a downslope, and it was hurting families across the neighborhood.
How old were you?
I was actually 15 years old. I mean, some people say I was 14, but...
You were 15 years old?
Yeah, but I was actually 15. At the time, I was turning 16 at August 25th, following after the disturbance.
Your family, friends around you in that community, struggling to find work?
Struggling to find work. Some of us were struggling to find a place to lay our head down, believe it or not. And some of the houses, as I explained to some people, had fire escapes. And on those fire escapes, you would find beds made up where you would have children laying out there on the fire escape sleeping. People slept in tubs. People slept wherever they can find a place, not necessarily where they can stretch out. Sometimes you had to lay down like you did when you were in the womb.
Mm. And Daryl, this is why I think this part of the discussion is so important, because many people in Rochester, if you grew up here, even if you've grown up here and you were not alive in 64, you might not know what those events were all about. If you moved to Rochester, like I did, you didn't hear about it from the outside. You might not understand the context. So you're describing neighborhoods, families struggling to find work, struggling to find places to sleep. But I think it's important to ask you if you felt that people were not finding work because there were no jobs or because they were denied jobs. People were not finding places to sleep because there was no room for people to find places to sleep, or you were discriminated against.
Well, all of the above. I mean, we were discriminated against. A lot of times you walk into a job and the fact that, you know, they looked at you and saw you, you were dead on arrival. Other times, you know, when you talked about housing, you could have a place to stay. But there was a difference between you sleeping in a clean place, in a safe place, or are you sleeping in a place that's rat infested or infested with roaches, you know? And in those places there, when people lay down, you know, they're trying to sleep, they may be getting bit by rats or getting bit by roaches. And a lot of people don't think roaches can bite. I can assure you, they do bite.
And give me a sense then, Daryl, when things sort of exploded that night, 50 years ago tonight, I remember seeing you in July 64 describing that people were picking up whatever they could find. They were throwing rock. Paint that picture for me.
Well, it was, like I said, everybody was out there for a different frustration. You know, you might have been out there because of your involvement in the community, whether it had to do with police brutality or whether it had to do with the lack of being turned down for 69 apartments and not being able to get one. You know, the fact that you couldn't sit down and have a decent meal. Those kinds of things, trying to feed your family, taking away your pride where you have children, but you don't feel like a dad because you can't take care of your family like you want to. So a lot of those issues and frustrations were building up. They were like, you know, like a hole in a dam. You know, you get that crack in that dam, and then you keep putting pressure on it, and sooner or later it's going to erode, and it's going to get bigger and bigger, and then it's going to explode. And that's what happened in the community. You had 10,000 jobs that weren't filled. You had more than enough people to fill them if you wanted to. But because of racism, they didn't want to.
I wanted to ask you, in the movie July 64, there seems to be this, there's two parts to the frustration. And people deal with frustration. We talked about this earlier on the show, different ways. Not saying that they're all positive, some are negative. But afterwards, when the 3 days are over, and news crews are coming to interview you or talk about what's going on, at what point do you say, okay, this went off on a Friday, but we can't let it go to a Saturday, and then we can't let it go to a Sunday, or we have to let people know why we're frustrated, and you had to talk to the media. You had to get, because no one was really listening to you prior to that riot.
Well, you're right. I mean, Friday was Friday. Saturday was planned, so we weren't looking to stop, you know, on Saturday. But Sunday was kind of different. Now, Sunday was, you know, like walking through the neighborhood and seeing a war zone. And when you did, and the fact that your mother couldn't go to the grocery store and walk down the street or couldn't even go to work because they would stop you from coming out of the house or getting into the neighborhood to get into your house kind of situation. And it turned out to be just horrible, you know. And at that point in time, you know, the reality of what happened in that neighborhood and what happened in your neighborhood really kind of sunk in.
But to Tariq's point, Friday's one thing. You wake up Saturday, you look around, you see storefronts knocked down. Mm-hmm. You see a lot of people hurt and arrested. And then you had to decide whether you wanted to do it again or to do more. Why go back out on Saturday?
Well, the decision was made on Friday to go back out on Saturday. That was already made, mm-hmm. All right? And the fact of it is that we didn't have a communication vehicle. We couldn't sit down and talk to the mayor. We couldn't sit down and talk to the chief of police or go to the superintendent of schools or the school board and talk to or city council and talk to. As young people, I don't know about how the elderly did, but as a young person, we had no avenue whatsoever to sit down and talk to anybody but the few people in our community like Connie Mitchell, Paul Branchoff, and Jim Pratt, and those folks in Franklin Florence, you know, that would listen to us and allow us to hear our side. But then we had to depend on them and Scott, you know, Raymond Scott's of the world, to go into that room and be able to portray exactly what we felt, you know, and what we thought should be done. We didn't know what happened behind that closed door. But we know after they came out of the closed door, there was no change.
But do you look back now, and at some point, did you start to feel that we shouldn't have done it?
No. No, even today, I believe we should have did it. Because if we hadn't have done it, we never would have gotten the attention that it should have gotten. We never would have been able to sit down with the powers to be. They never would have listened to us at all. These young people today wouldn't have that avenue to be able to go in the city hall and have a meeting, sit down face to face, you know, with the powers to be. They wouldn't have been listened to at all. When we walk into a police department to complain about anything, we will find ourselves up against the wall, down on the ground, all before we can even explain why we're there. Mm. You know, today, that doesn't happen. You know, they allow you to come in. You can say whatever you want to say. You may not stay, depending on what you say, but at least you have that avenue that you can sit down, make an appointment, and talk.
But do you think Martin Luther King, for example, would be able to evaluate this and say, that was proper, that was the right behavior at the time?
Well, Martin Luther King would have said we would have hoped we didn't have to get there. All right? First of all, Martin Luther King could sit down with the administration and talk. We could not sit down with the administration and talk. All right? So Martin Luther King would have tried to do all of the nonviolence that he could, but the people he was representing sooner or later was going to turn to violence if nonviolence didn't work.
What about the businesses that were looted or destroyed? I mean, we're talking 200 businesses, a core of a part of the community.
And that's a loss to the community, you know, to have those businesses out there. But a lot of those businesses, and I have to tell you, a lot of those businesses were crooks, you know, point blank. They were out there sucking off the neighborhood, you know, taking everything they can take out of it and taking it out wherever they lived at and spending their money there. Now, when you start talking about the Mangione's Market, that's the difference. The difference was that was a community market. That was a family market for everybody, and everybody knew this. They didn't have the money to pay for it right then and there, and they had family at home that was hungry. They know the Mangione's would feed them. They would give it to them, put it on the books, pay them when you can.
But, Darrell, are you saying every one of those 200 businesses that got damaged or looted were crooked?
No, not every one of them. Enough of them. More than enough of them that was crooked. And what I would tell you is a lot of them didn't have any relationship with the people they were serving. A lot of them didn't. The Mangione's did. And it shows the difference. How do you explain how they passed over him? And it's almost like what was in the Bible when they put the blood on the door and death passed over the door. That's what happened in the neighborhood with his family. They were marked and people passed over that door because they knew not to mess with the family that was feeding them.
Gap, is that an accurate description?
No. Well, sort of. We were very much part of the neighborhood. We certainly lived there. I was born three doors away from the grocery store, as were my siblings. My father ran the grocery store. We lived there. We were certainly part of the community. Early on and later on, the community changed. I think our attitude toward it did not. I know our attitude did not. We were part of it. My mother and father had the grocery store. It was what they were. It was what we were in the community. And at first, it was mostly a lot of friends and relatives of ours who lived there. And as it changed, again, our feeling within the community was as a community. We cared about each other. That's something that I remember so vividly, even now, feeling pretty much at home there with these people. And there were other things, as Darrell mentioned, my father was very generous with the people who came to the store, and he was always good and fair with them. We were reasonably well known. As a matter of fact, yesterday in the conversation that we had about the documentary, I tried to open the focus up just a tiny bit so it wasn't right at this thing at this time to mention that it was only 2 months earlier that Chuck and I had our first experience playing with symphony orchestras. We played first with the Syracuse Symphony in March that year with the Rochester Philharmonic. Within a couple of weeks of the rioting, Duke Ellington not only played with the Rochester Philharmonic, recorded with them, and that music is what is behind the documentary. Now, in the middle of that came this uprising. Another thing happened. on a particular day, I think it was 3 days earlier or 4 days earlier, my father's grocery store was kind of the center of the community. He had the only payphone, and it was a gathering place. Our house immediately attached to the store so that the door from the kitchen opened into the store, and it was always open so we could see. I heard a woman in the store screaming and yelling about how her baby had drowned. Well, I naturally, we both, Chuck and I, went out there. And
you were how old, Gap?
We were in our 20s.
I'm giving a lot away with the age thing here today, but you know, that's okay.
We were there between semesters at Syracuse University. Went out to see what had happened. I thought that she had heard via the phone about the tragedy with her baby. Turns out that she had put an older daughter and this one-year-old son in the tub, turned her attention to some cooking, looked back. The daughter had gotten out of the tub, and the boy was face down in it. Suffice it to say that Chuck went over first, I got there second, and the baby was essentially unresponsive, and we, through very, very ad-lib kind of reaction to what was going on, found a way to, and we got him breathing, and he survived. And I was astounded this very week, 4 days, on last Friday, I heard from that guy.
But, wow. And you had, and you had, you hadn't,
first time in 50 years.
First time in 50 years.
Yes.
How did that conversation go?
It happened via Facebook.
Wow.
He found me on there, and he wrote to me. James Larkin, who's now a construction worker in Atlanta.
What did that mean to you?
Oh, it fairly leaves me speechless.
but to Daryl's point, this is exactly what he was talking about in the last segment. Uh-huh. This isn't just an African American male.
Yes.
This is just the part of the past that the African American community appreciates. Mm-hmm. You didn't just go and save a child. You saved a child within the community.
Mm-hmm. True.
And it resonates so big that word spread. There's no Facebook back then. So
I hear that.
She tells her friends and her family at church, wherever mm-hmm. they go, the word spreads over a certain amount of time, and that equity is built up because you see human beings. You don't see
yes.
color.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the, you know, when Daryl's talking before about the past, and there is this feeling of you. I appreciate you because you understand that you're not lumping everyone together. No, you see a human.
We.
Yeah.
The neighborhood is
we.
Not you
yeah.
and you and you.
Exactly.
And we.
It's not just this person right. and that person. You saw everyone.
Yes. Let me make one other point. When they say they just didn't come to our place, that's not true. The second night, my mother insisted that we leave, and we did. We packed whatever we could into
on Saturday.
Yes. Mm-hmm. As a matter of fact, we were involved in playing at, you know, we played at the Pitha. We were among a fairly small group of white people in the place, and we were there regularly, not only in terms of customers, but in terms of the players. We were involved in the community. But we left, and it was after we came back that we found out that there was a marauding gang who had come specifically to our place. Now, we had a certain advantage of being far enough away from the initial explosion so that we weren't a natural place to come to. People had to come to find us. But the neighbors, peeking through their blinds in the middle of the night, saw what was going on and came out. And discouraged is the best word I can say.
Said, leave them alone.
Exactly that.
And they did?
Yes.
So no damage to Mangione's Market over those times.
Not a mark.
Professor Clofus, when you hear these stories, first of all, Gap's story of saving the child is now man. It gives me hope in a lot of ways because this has been a dark period in Rochester's past, but there are people who accuse the media of sort of celebrating this. I think we're trying to learn from it. What are the most important lessons you see?
You know, I think Gap's story is an incredible story, and it really marks the changes. It's a good barometer in many ways of the changes that have occurred. At that time, in the early 60s, Rochester was changing very, very fast, and those neighborhoods were changing very, very fast. And This wasn't only Rochester, too. Rochester was the first of the places to riot, and there was a series of urban riots afterwards that really put Rochester in the forefront of those in some ways. And then the forefront of those incredible changes. In the 1950 census, Rochester was 330,000 people, and only 5% of those were minorities. So by the early 60s, that had grown substantially, and it was except for the sort of personal situations that Gap speaks about so well, it was a set of relationships in which there was a great deal of tension.
And I think in a failure to adapt to a community becoming more diverse.
I think that's exactly right. And, it was true then, and it's still the biggest struggle that goes on in this community today.
The sad part is that things were going so well in the 50s and early 60s with manufacturing and jobs. And there were, as Daryl said, there were jobs open, and this community could have chosen to adapt and said, open arms, you know, we've got new families coming from the South. They're escaping some of the worst of what's going on. And they sort of, in many ways, failed to do it. But the nice thing is, not everybody. Obviously, yeah. That's why Gap's here, but in many ways failed to do it.
But there were some unique features of Rochester that weren't duplicated in other places. If you look at that 1950 census, when Rochester is 5% minority, the other cities around the Great Lakes were 12 and 15 and 18% minority, mm-hmm. because you had a migration out of the South to industrial jobs, mm-hmm. which were really the way to move up the ladder overall. And Rochester didn't have those same manufacturing jobs. They had chemical processing jobs. So not only were the organizations really hesitant about hiring people, but the economic foundation was different and required higher education and skill levels. So people were sort of doubly troubled in terms of trying to make it in this particular economy. This was a very tough and a very, very different place. And that economic difference is one that I think continues to reverberate.
But let me ask you about Daryl's contention. Mm-hmm. Daryl making the contention that these 3 days – again, call them riots or demonstrations or rebellion, these 3 days were necessary as a form of communication, that unfortunately there was no other way for that community to do it, and that it at least made an impact that is somehow more positive to this day. Is that spinning history, or do you think there's some evidence?
I don't think that spins history at all, to be honest with you. I think it's certainly true by any objective measures. The conditions Daryl describes are exactly what he stated them. And I think there was plenty of reasons for enormous frustration at that time. And there was, I think you make a very good case, Daryl, that there was really no way of addressing, no way of communicating, no way of expressing those frustrations in a way that would be productive in the traditional sense of that. That I think was very, very true at the time. And one of the big changes that have occurred is not necessarily in the objective conditions of any of this, but in those avenues that can at least have people heard and addressed. So.
We're talking about 50 years ago to this evening, the riots in Rochester, July 64, and tonight on City 12, 7 and 10 p.m., you can watch the documentary July 64, or this coming Sunday at 11 p.m. to get a sense for that. You'll see Daryl Porter in that. You'll see Gap Mangione in that. You'll see some of familiar faces and telling the stories of what happened. But our goal today with WDKX and WXXI working together is to try to learn and move forward. And Tariq Spence is here from WDKX as we simulcast. I'm amazed at how much I'm learning, and you feel like you understand history, but then you hear it from the people who made it.
Well, the fact that John made this point about a lot of the issues that were big then are still issues today means we still have a lot more work to do. And the other interesting thing about this is that, you know, it doesn't really matter what generation you come from. If you're willing to support or just look at and give opportunities to individuals, it can go a long way. And I think whether it's 50 years ago or just today, the opportunities are available to advance and to move on that weren't there when Daryl. And he'll be the first one to tell you they weren't there. Because before he got to the door, the answer was no. But, you know, you still persist on. It resulted in a number of different committees. It resulted in change and in time. and realizing that, you know, the riots, okay, 3 days later are done, but let's see where we can go from here and build this relationship, because a lot of people didn't know this was going on in the city of Rochester.
Before we get to the shortest break in radio, let's grab a phone call. This is Hoover in Pittsford. Thanks for calling Connections. Go ahead, Hoover.
Yeah, thanks, Evan. This is a very interesting show. I grew up in Rochester. I was a teenager when this happened. And Daryl, how you doing?
All right.
I knew your brother Emmett from the Third Ward, and we in the past, but. My grandmother lived on off Avenue D. Some of my relatives lived off Avenue D. I went to 22 school, and then I went to a city school. My mom went to Franklin. My dad went to Edison. We knew what was going on. And, you know, I have some interesting comments here. The institutions in Rochester, political, social institutions, had not geared up for the immigration that occurred from southern states.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, that's clearly one of the major causes. But it's a two-way street. There's the requirement of adaptability of people. You know, I moved to South Carolina when I was in my 30s, and I knew that I had to adapt. Well, people moved up here that just didn't understand the culture they were moving into, and the adaptation methodology they used was negligent. And, you know, it happens. It happened with Irish. It happened with any other group that comes in and has low income status and low skill status. Now, the Rochester City School District did not adapt quickly enough for the changes. And I talked to some of my minority friends. I played sports. I played baseball and football with some of the folks. And I called them during the next day on Saturday of the riot. And I asked a couple of men, what the hell's going on over there? They went to Franklin. And they said, we're not part of this stuff. There's a bunch of crazy guys doing some stuff. And we're not going to get involved, because they were athletes and they knew if they got involved, they'd get kicked off the baseball team and the football, stuff like that. So, you know, and I appreciate Gap's story about his store. And, you know, I knew some of the stores on Joseph Avenue. I was there when I was a kid. You know, there's a lot of things positive and negative about what happened. And it's interesting how we can dissect it and talk about it now. But I really think your program is enhancing our understanding of this as a community. And Daryl, you always do a great job, and I'm glad you're on the program. Same thing with you, Evan, and I'll get off and listen now.
Yeah, Hoover, that's very nice of you to say, and I appreciate the call. And Tariq and I have been saying that all day. I'm amazed when people say, you can't talk about race, or you can't talk. You know, I think you can talk about anything, and if you do it in a productive way, everybody benefits.
Well, you got to be honest and want to get into the dialogue. And we were talking about this earlier on the show. It just is uncomfortable for a lot of people, and you've got to understand that. But you also got to make sure that you find a way to, I can't say make it comfortable, but at least have it out there, because these little hidden discussions aren't helping, and they haven't helped over the years. So you've got to be willing to take that leap and have it. Evan and I have been talking about this all day. If you don't want to, a lot of people will, and it'll continue on.
And didn't you say it should be uncomfortable?
Yeah.
That's all right.
It's not easy. It's not easy for Daryl to talk about this story. It's not easy for a lot of people to talk about these stories, because there's good and bad to it, but you have to.
All right. I see the phone's continuing to ring. We're going to get to the shortest break in radio. We're going to come back and get a little bit more perspective on this and continue with our panel here. Daryl Porter, a past assistant to two mayors in Rochester and was there during those events 50 years ago. Gap Mangione's family-owned Mangione's Market. And of course, Gap, part of a great music family and a piano player, but also sharing his perspective from the John Clofus, RIT professor, is here. Tariq Spence from WDKX, as we're proud to simulcast with our partners over at WDKX. I'm Evan Dawson. We're right back on Member Supported Public Radio. Coming up in our second hour on WXXI, Governor Andrew Cuomo is taking serious heat for refusing to let the Moreland Commission investigate his political allies. The governor had promised to allow the commission to go after corruption wherever they found it. Now it turns out that Cuomo wanted to be exempt from examination. We'll hear from the Republican candidate for governor, Rob Astorino, among others. That's next hour on Connections.
When is a toy more than a toy? Well, first of all, it's got to be branded as a lifetime companion.
Over time, this doll becomes my friend. And that friendship is really, really uncommon. Most toys don't have that kind of emotional connection.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. My trip to an American Girl store, next time on Marketplace from 8 p.m.
This evening at 6:30.
Well, welcome back to Connections, both on WXXI, AM 1370, WEOS Finger Lakes Public Radio, online at WXXI.org, and on the WXXI mobile app, or today, simulcasting on WDKX 103.9 FM. Proud to be there. Proud to have my colleague Michelle Faust here, sharing some more perspective. I know you and our entire WXXI staff has been reporting on this week. Tonight, you're going to join my colleague Helen B. and Duty Hofer on Need to Know with a roundtable. One of the interviews you did brought even some more perspective to this issue, Michelle.
That's right. So there are a series of tours. There'll be some more tours next week that are looking at Joseph Avenue and stopping along the way and looking at different sites of different events, of things that happened during the Rochester riots of 1964. The person who's putting that together, who's organizing that, is Professor Virtus Robinson. He's a professor of history and African-American studies at Monroe Community College. And I joined him and spoke with him right before a tour last week. Professor Robinson, you had mentioned, I thought it was very interesting, because right before the break you guys discussed how there aren't very many discussions about race, but Professor Robinson, you said because of that lack of discussion about race, you didn't learn about the July 64 riots until you were an adult. Isn't that correct?
Yes, that is correct. I lived in Chatham Gardens, that's where I was born and raised, in 400 Court, actually, and when I was young, I was bused out with the Urban Suburban Interdistrict Transfer Program out to Brighton School District. So I was kind of bused out from the community, and at that time, a lot of people really didn't talk about the history of that area. I just assumed that it was always a predominantly African-American area. In fact, where Tops is now, there used to be a grocery store called Bell's. And we used to walk across an empty field to get to Bell's. I had no idea that there were all these shops, grocery stores, pharmacies, where an empty field was when I grew up. But the way I got in touch with the history of that area was through a history book. I was reviewing American history textbooks, and then I came across that there was a riot in Rochester in one of my history textbooks. So I started to ask my parents about it, and sure enough, they were there.
So Professor Robinson, I'd like you to talk to us a little about how these walking tours have gone. What have been some of the reaction to the people who've come? Because I imagine there are some people who are coming to reminisce, who have their own histories there, but some people who've probably never been in the neighborhood before and really don't know much about it.
And I'll speak to the first part. It's very interesting. Just last week, we had an older lady, I believe she was in her 90s, and she was out there with us, you know, walking around. And so one of the stops on Joseph Avenue is the Jewish synagogue. And some people were like, okay, well, we drove up and down Joseph Avenue. We always drive down, and we never have seen this before. And then she said, well, I got married there. So with that, I asked her, do you have any pictures? Because I've never seen any pictures of inside that synagogue. But more importantly, what that shows is that just that being there, one question that I had and I posed to my students, because it really was the students in my honors American history class that compiled this walking tour and came up with the stops, was that why is the Jewish synagogue doing in the middle of a predominantly African-American neighborhood? And that is because of the historical transformation of that neighborhood.
Well, and let me ask, and stay there, Professor, but let me ask Daryl Porter this question. Daryl, in the last week, again, I am a student of history who's learning right along with so many people this week about what happened. In the last week, I have heard on social media, on phone lines on this program, in conversations in Rochester, some people say that those events 50 years ago are what effectively pushed the Jewish community to Brighton, that that the victims of those riots were the Jewish and the white community. What do you make of that contention, Daryl?
I can't answer that because I don't know. What I can tell you is that, and it's, I'm glad he brought up about the Jewish synagogue being there, because actually right now, they had City Hall in down on the first floor. They're showing pictures from July 64, and the picture of their synagogue is on being shown right today. So if you get a chance to go to City Hall, check the pictures out. You'll be able to see it and enjoy how beautiful it really was.
So it was a little bit, obviously it was a different feel to that area back 50 years ago. And in some ways we have lost that, haven't we, Daryl?
No, we definitely lost it, you know. It's something that we can recreate all over again, and which is what I'm hoping would happen. Not only there, but also areas of Jefferson Avenue and Plymouth Avenue areas and Clarissa Street.
Well, Professor Virtus Robinson, before we let you go here, and again, I apologize because Michelle has done such a great job reporting on this. I didn't even catch when people can do the tours or if they still can. Can they?
There'll be two more times next week. I'll let Professor Robinson remind us.
Please do.
I don't have the notes in front of me.
Yes. So next Tuesday and Thursday, so July 29th and July 31st, at 4 o'clock, and we start off at the Lincoln Branch Library on the corners of Joseph Avenue and Avenue D. And so we start off with a discussion, and then we go out into the tours, and then we come back, and then we discuss it further. The main part of the tour is not a show and tell. It's more of, okay, look at these pictures, look at how the neighborhood was, and how the neighborhood has changed over the 50 years. And to answer, I would like to add my two cents
sure.
to that question. It wasn't the riots that that pushed the Jewish community out. It was the tools of de facto segregation. What I'm talking about is redlining, blockbusting, and white flight. Those tours, it was mostly an economic flight rather than, okay, here are these African Americans now. Because of the Fair Housing Act, they're moving into this neighborhood, and okay, there goes the neighborhood. It was more than that. It was the tools of de facto segregation, and that's why Rochester is very much segregated to this very day, and a lot of the cities in the north are that way as well. And when my parents came up here in 1963, which is a year before the riots, they came up with bachelor's degrees. But Kodak wouldn't open up its doors, Xerox wouldn't open up, so they lived in Hanover houses because there's no other place for them to go. They couldn't get jobs that were in their fields. My father has a bachelor's degree in biology, and he couldn't find a job here in Rochester. So that really controlled where these new migrant African Americans were going to be in Rochester. And so they had to live on the opposite side of Herman Street. But when we have white flight, when we have blockbusting and redlining, and more then the white community were moving out of the neighborhoods, the black community moved in. But still, they were the houses that they moved into were too much, and a lot of them could not afford that, especially without the jobs. So we see a lot of rundown houses right now. And it wasn't because the black folks didn't know how to take care of their homes. It's because financially they couldn't. So, I mean, and it's a larger problem. And my one question is not just what happened but what can we do? What can we do because, and not really can this happen again, because there are not a lot of shops on Joseph Avenue to be looted. But the real problem is the future of that community, the children that live there, and where their future is going to be, because that ties into the future of Rochester itself.
Professor, I appreciate that. And for anybody asking about signing up for the tours, how do they get in touch with you to do that?
Oh, no sign up is necessary. Just show up at 4 o'clock. We have guidebooks and that you can take with you. And even after the two tours, I can be available for additional tours if necessary. And also, they're self-guided. So we'll have some available at the Lincoln Branch Library, as well as at MCC. So if you want to just pick up the guidebook and go on the tour yourself at any time, you can do that.
Professor, thanks for taking the time to join us this hour.
And thanks for having me.
All right. We'll let him go now. Michelle, we'll see you tonight on Need to Know with the Reporters Roundtable. 8 p.m. on WXXI-TV. Thank you.
And listen to All Things Considered this afternoon to hear my piece.
Ah, very good. So my colleague right. Michelle Faust has been reporting extensively on these issues this week. If you're just joining us, we're talking about 50 years ago, what happened tonight. We're simulcasting on WDKX, my co-host, Tariq Spence. And Professor Clofas, let me kick it to you. He says we've got to find a way to, you know, sort of end de facto segregation and you know, improve our community going forward. Are there model cities? Where can we look and find ways to start making a positive change?
You know, I think there are lots of models around, and there are lots of places that have confronted exactly what Rochester has confronted and been more successful at that. So there are unified school districts around that went through many of the same things that we've gone through here.
Wake County, changed. North Carolina, by the way, is an example where they integrated in 1976. Right. They merged essentially two districts, an urban, mostly minority, and a suburban, mostly white, and to this day still merged and not perfect, but a lot of people look at it as a model.
There are places that have invested in structures that do not foster and support segregation, and that is not what we have managed to do here.
Right.
The structure of public service, the structure of government, really fosters those kinds of outcomes. Our response to this has been more along the lines of a conversation about race without regard for the policies that continue to create the circumstances that we had in 1964 and not improve those conditions substantially in objective terms to today.
Let's grab another phone call. This is Bernard in Fairport. Bernard, thanks for calling Connections.
Thank you. I came to Rochester in 1965 after the upset here, and one of the things that drove me crazy was people focused on the violence in the street instead of the underlying problem. And mm-hmm. to some degree, I've heard this theme in the show, which is about, you know, did people have a right to destroy the stores and so on and so forth. And I think what happens is that people use that as a distraction. When you go to Britain and ask them about the American Revolution, what are they going to say? So it seems to me that we need to be careful about putting this riot in front of the real problem, which went on hundreds of years before 64 and is still going on. So instead of focusing on the violence and the incorrectness of a riot or a street uprising, we need to focus on the fact that we haven't really integrated our society. We're not really what we think we are in terms of being open to different races and so on and so forth. So I appreciate the fact that we're doing away with this theme of, you know, let's focus on the violence instead of focusing on the real problem.
That's a great call, Bernard. I appreciate that. And we've said a week ago when we started covering this, that very theme, and Tariq and I talked this morning, and I said, if you start looking at what happened 50 years ago tonight without anything before that, you may look at that and say, well, those people were, why were they behaving that way? You have to go back to 1950. You have to go back to 1930 when black families were moving to Chicago and other cities and they couldn't even get legitimate mortgages. They were taken advantage of. Those things were all building toward 1964. I'm not here telling you that I don't know if I agree with Daryl Porter that it should have happened or that, you know, but at the same time, those conditions were there, and they are part of the story.
But I think the caller's point is no one wants to ask the question why. They just want to answer it themselves why, instead of actually going to want to know, okay, why would you want to do that? Mm-hmm. You do realize that. And after the fact—
You mean they want to assume the worst about humans,
exactly,
right?
Exactly, or whatever they've been told. And that's the wrong approach. You actually have to go ask why, because it's a form of respect. Why would you do that? Why would you want to do? And then maybe you're enlightened to a world that's outside of that bubble. We were talking earlier about this sort of bubble sometimes people live in. And they live in different areas. They live in different communities. Some of them are online. They're in a bubble. Some of them are in their economical bubble. Some are in their cultural bubble and never want to step out. And this is his question of why is the best question you can ask. Because you've got to be willing to open to answer that question.
Absolutely right. I mean, Gap, as a family who was right there in the neighborhood or right around the corner, I mean, you get a better sense of why. But in the 50 years that have followed since, have you heard friends? Have you heard people in the people that you spend time with occasionally remark on what happened 50 years ago? And do you find yourself stepping in to say, look, it was more complicated than a thousand people going nuts on the street.
It certainly was more complicated. This was it, taken in the whole context. It was fairly small. Not to say it was.
I don't think you make it, yeah. Not to say that's
okay,
insignificant.
But
yeah.
let me mention one thing that I found only recently. The night of the riots, or the next night, a fellow whose name was Joe Wilson, who was CEO of Xerox at the time. Now Xerox was not only big then, but exploded in terms of it. He went over to a Reverend Scott, I think that's the name. I read about it. I wasn't there. And said, you know, I have a company here, and you're looking for jobs, and why don't we find something to do about it? Now, it was never in the papers or any kind of – I didn't find out about it until just the other day. And having worked at the restaurant in Xerox over the course of years and years, I saw the change. Joe Wilson said he would do something about it, and he did, from the factory floor through the management, and guess who's CEO of the company now. The tendency seems to be to turn to the public sector to try to deal with this problem. I wonder how many really special individual avenues there are of this sort. I mean, Joe Wilson was a unique and very, very special man, and he certainly was in the position to have an effect. I just find it interesting that we're always looking to try to find some public sector solution to these difficulties.
You mean government solution?
Well, okay, yes.
Okay, and that's fair enough, but Daryl Porter's worked in government now, and don't you at least think that we've talked about policy. Carvin Eisen's talked about policy, the director of the film, saying, you know, if your policy favors de facto segregation, don't expect to change.
Exactly, and you're absolutely right about that. And talking about Joe did go over to Franklin Florence and Scott over at the fight and made that attempt to say, here's a resource that I have. You know, how can I help the community? And we need more of that.
Oh, indeed.
We need more people who have the resources to be willing to share it with the community.
And the heart to do it.
And the heart to do it.
Let's grab Rich. Oh, I lost Rich in Rochester. Jane in Rochester. Go ahead, Jane.
Yes, you were talking about why. Well, one of your guests answered that, saying we felt we weren't heard. And so the normal roots of being heard and taken seriously were blocked, apparently. But it is interesting that recently we've learned that Rochester, for its town, its size in the nation, is second in poverty. And I'd like to expand this from blacks to include whites in poverty and Mexicans and Puerto Ricans. I mean, our poverty goes across all sorts of lines. But you've already been told they want to be heard as others would be heard and be respected. So, and also this thing about redlining, an individual, I don't believe, can by himself do a lot about that. It takes the courts, it takes a lot of people. And I'm worried about this gentrification thing because, again, we're moving people around. And, you know, we don't want to repeat mistakes of the past. But anyway, thank you very much.
Thanks, Jane. Professor Clovis, when you hear gentrification, what's an easy definition?
I think gentrification is in fact, the movement of people with means and resources into some neighborhoods and displacing people who may have been there for generation after generation after generation. I think it's a very significant problem, but it's part of a very complicated mix of problems that has affected this community with regard to patterns of housing, where the opportunities are very, very limited still.
I got about 2 minutes left here, so let's kind of go around the room. Daryl Porter, are you more hopeful now than you were 5, 10 years ago, that we're moving past July 64? Are we still mired in those problems?
I'm more hopeful now because we're communicating now. Now we have avenues to be able to release some of that steam and that pressure that's being built up. If there's no way for you to express yourself or to be able to sit out and be heard, then eventually you're going to keep it all pinned up inside of you till it's got to come out, and 9 times out of 10, it's going to come out the wrong way.
Gap Mangione, when you go back to that area, if you ever do, it's not the same as it was 50 years ago. Do you have hope that eventually it could be back that way someday?
Well, it's a Coca-Cola plant now. They leveled that entire neighborhood and took it from. But I'm hopeful. I certainly am hopeful. I'm not sure that I'm inspired by what's going on politically, just generally. And those are the places that we seem to be looking for solutions. I'm not sure they're going to come from there.
Yeah, and that's been a theme. I know you've hit on that, but I think Gap's point is it takes a lot of people, and it takes more than government. It takes it takes the private sector, and it takes communities, it takes neighbors.
And people connecting with each other.
Yeah, the way that maybe 50 years later you hear from somebody that you never thought you'd hear from again. And if you missed that story, go to the podcast and listen to it, because Gap's story inspired all of us. Tariq, do you feel hope after today?
I do, and the reason why is because I think we know now, one, we're more comfortable with the discussion. We're more comfortable with the discussion on air. And we're really interested now in connecting not just on this human level, but there's so many different ways to express yourself. Because I think now there wasn't so many ways to express yourself. I think now there is, through art, through either through music or through spoken word or hosting your own show or whatever it may be, through video, through Facebook, through wherever it may be. So there's a lot of openings to express and get different opinions.
Beautifully said, Tariq. It's been fun working with you today.
Man, it's been all day.
I know. And we're going to do it again soon. We're going to have some partnerships with WDKX, where we've been simulcasting on their water cooler this morning from 9 to 10 and here on Connections from noon to 1. Great working with you, Tariq. Thank you.
A pleasure. Thank you for working with us and WDKX and those connections building together.
You got it. Daryl Porter, nice to see you. Thank you.
All right. Thank you for having
me. Absolutely. Gap Mangione, thank you for sharing your time.
Thank you for your invitation.
Professor Clofus, always great to get your perspective.
Good to be here. Thank you.
And thank you for the calls. We're continuing next hour with Rob Astorino and questions about the governor next.